to my understanding, you know, it's a big deal in the gene editing community, but it also raises some ethical questions. So wanted to hear your thoughts on those as well.
Well, my thoughts are the same, I think, as most people. I'm not comfortable with this kind of research for ethical reasons, although it is very hard to stop mature science from moving forward, particularly in credible labs. And so it was inevitable that this would happen, even though the scientific community, particularly at the National Academy of Science, had put some soft controls on the use of this approach. So I was a little surprised that this had come along so quickly, but I'm also fairly experienced and a senior person in the field. So I'm also aware of experiments that you don't hear about that are going on. So this is just happens to be one that seems to have worked and has entered in the public domain. So I was about as surprised as everybody that this got out.
So what sort of ethical questions does this raise?
That's a incredibly important question, and that's an understatement itself. I think there are a couple facts that need to be understood. The major concern in the popular press and with ethicists is that this will create an avenue for designing children with a particular eye color, hair color, athletic ability, and that is very unlikely, even if this technology moves forward, simply because those traits are controlled by a large number of genes that interact. And we don't even know 90% of what those genes are. So I think from the ethical concerns that are often raised as designer babies, that's really a catchy, jargony phrase, but it's not truly appropriate. The ethical argument here that worries, I think, true geneticists like me, is that when you create something and change something at the start of a human life, essentially you have introduced that change into the germline, which means that every descendant of that child will have that change. And of course, while the intention is to repair a faulty gene that causes a disease, at the end of the day, you don't know what else you've done. And once that has happened, the horse is out of the barn. You can't recall that change. So that genetic change is permanent, and it's also in what we know as the germline, which then means descendants of that particular child or person will actually maintain that change. So it sounds great if it's just a particular gene, but the worry is that we don't know what else has happened in the genome. Even though these researchers claim nothing else has happened, I've been in the field a long time, and things pop up as cells age, or in this case, as a child gets older. So you've introduced a new variant into a population and you can't get it back. It's now moved into the human population. If it's to repair genes and have children avoid having cystic fibrosis or thalassemia or congenital heart defects, that of course is wonderful and we all hope for that. But it's the unseen changes that are likely to be introduced here that cause people some concern.
You talk about some really important things. And I also wanted to make sure, I wanted to clarify a term. You had said something about, like, you know, basically if you change something at the start of a human life, every descendant going forward would have that change. And you said some term, I think, germline. I don't know if
germline, yeah. So the germline is the sperm and the egg. So if you change a germline means that there's a mutation that occurs either you inherit from your parents. So if there's a particular, you know, if you have cystic fibrosis and you bear a child, you pass that gene on to the child. That's called germline changes. That is what's happened here, is that the change now will be in every cell in the body, and that change, including that child's sperm or egg. And then when that child has children, that change that we've induced here gets passed on to subsequent generations. So that's really what the debate is about. Do we change germline so that now it's out into the population? It cannot be recalled. That's the major concern. And those thoughts, I think, are actually borne by a lot of scientists who understand the power of gene editing. I'm very thrilled, obviously, with the science around it. It advances the field, and we've contributed to this field for a long time. But I think there are practical applications, and sometimes doing what you can is not doing the right thing. And I think that's the concern now. How do we control this so we don't create a situation where we make mutations that we cannot recall, and you can't get them back once they're in the population, because this is in the germline and in the child beginning. And at the end of the day, they're there forever and they can't be recalled.
So could you essentially, since this goes down after every single, every descendant, you potentially take, you can't reverse the gene that you've edited or cut, but can't you potentially work with another gene that could, this is going to sound stupid, but couldn't you even it out even with another gene?
Right. Actually, that's actually a very good question. And that's really getting to the point where you begin to begin to sort of modulate a set of genes that all work in the same pathway, do the same thing. Then you get into that multiplier effect. So if you do two, then the next time you might have to do three and four and five. And so, yes, and that's where it would drift into the complexity of trying to change what we call complex traits, which sometimes include eye color and hair color. So you'd open sort of a Pandora's box where this is one time, and then, okay, well, we'll change the next one, and so we'll do it again. And now you've got four or five iterations of this going forward, and you're manipulating the germline of children going down, and now you've got people with all different kinds of changes, certainly some for the better. And I think scientifically we're all excited, and, we all work on therapy, so we'd like this to happen, but it's just an area that I believe is just not ready yet for prime time. And lots of discussions about the ethical implications and the controls of this have to be put in place before we get too far down the line.
And you yourself, so you do a lot of work with gene editing and genetic therapies for inherited orders like sickle cell disease, right?
Right.
So can you sort of speak to the broader concept of gene editing and, why it's an important and a solution for science with, what you're doing?
So gene editing has come along, and it's actually in the last 5 years because of the development of a new tool called CRISPR, which is it's sort of an enzyme or a clipping enzyme, a scissors, pair of molecular scissors that actually is able to precisely, within a large degree precisely, change genes. And that has allowed us, using some of the old tools, some of which we developed and other people have developed through the years, in combination, to now go in and change the DNA and the chromosomes of people who have specific inherited diseases like sickle cell anemia. And in our case, we work on various forms of cancer here. So, but what we use, the cells we use, generally come from the bone marrow. And the difference is while those bone marrow cells are, in fact, progenitor cells, in other words, they can give rise to red blood cells or white blood cells or various other kinds of cells, they themselves cannot turn into a child. So they're not a germline. They're not sperm or egg. They're actually just the cell that you already contain in your body. And those cells we call somatic cells. So those are the types of therapies I think that people are most excited about. Gene editing will change medicine. If you can do something at the gene level, you begin to get at the cause of the disease. Most medicines treat the symptoms, obviously with great success in some cases. But gene editing is already affecting medicine in a very strong way. And when we built this institute here, we are introducing gene editing as part of the treatments for lung cancer or melanoma. And we see that coming very, very soon. Our goal is to really utilize gene editing to reverse the sickle cell mutation in blood cells. But also another project in the lab is for us to develop a therapy where we can work alongside chemotherapy or radiation therapy when people are being treated with lung cancer. And the reason for that is the gene editing will actually reduce the amount of chemotherapy or radiation they have to take. So you're working in combination with things that are already being tried in patients, but you're reducing the side effects. And that goal, I think, is quite reachable. And here at Christiana, particularly in lung cancer, we're very heavily focused on that. So our program does not involve embryonic stem cells. Our program involves progenitor cells that are already in the bone marrow, and we're able to take them out, modify them, and put them back in. So there's a fairly strong distinction between what happened with embryonic cells and with what the rest of the world works with in gene editing.
Is there anything else you wanted to add, either about the news or about what ChristianaCare has been doing?
I think two things. I think ChristianaCare has seen that gene editing is going to have a major impact on the future. And we don't know if that's this year, next year, with what you and I are reading about or hearing about, or when I'm getting emails from colleagues about, it seems like it's coming sooner than later. But I think just having us in place, being able to interact with the patients themselves and with physicians and with people who study the response to certain kinds of treatments of patients, is really forward-thinking and progressive, and that's very good. The Institute began in 2015. I was a professor at the University of Delaware for a long time. I've known Dr. Nick Petrelli, who's the head of the Cancer Center, and we felt it was time to move over and be embedded within a cancer center where these doctors and surgeons and patients all hear, so we could learn about what it's like to treat a human patient as opposed to treating a lab rat, and that's been extremely informative. Beyond that, we have a mission to help educate the students of Delaware, both in college and high school. We've developed a gene editing curriculum and a laboratory exercise that we're launching very soon in combination with the National Science Foundation. We received a very large grant from them to do this and to push it out into the community. So students, and even in the high school level, will be able to do gene editing in their classrooms, obviously in very benign situations, no human cells, but there are other cells that can be used. And that teaches the new group of scientists coming forward what it's about, and might even encourage a few of them to get into this field. And God knows we need some smart people in this field. Things are moving quickly and we need some help. So I think the education piece of what the Gene Editing Institute here is doing has been surprisingly successful. It was something we thought we started just to try to give back a little bit to the community, to the Delaware High Schools and to Community College, Del Tech here, et cetera. But it's gained some momentum because folks really realize that gene editing will be part of their sons or daughters education, particularly obviously in the STEM area going forward. So that's been really rewarding to watch that program grow.